Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
Wow. Well, after that amazing intro, I'm really, really pleased to be joined by such great guests and my co-host, Pratik, as well. Pratik, I'm going to introduce first. He's actually a penetration tester and an ethical hacker with a conscience. And he is differently abled. He uses a one-handed keyboard. And, you know, we've known each other for a little while. And I've been very happy that he's agreed to host this with me, because he's quite knowledgeable in the cyber industry so far in his career, early on. And I've got two veterans here from cybersecurity. David Clark, I've actually interviewed before, and Alan Gregg, I haven't interviewed as yet. But David is the founder of the GDPR Technology Forum with over 21,000 members, and he's an internationally known GDPR and security advisor. In the past, he's held multiple security management positions, such as global head of security, service delivery, and chief of staff, global head of product enablement, and head of security infrastructure for global FTSE 100 companies. And Alan Gregg is engaged by law enforcement, private sector, and the high profile to advise on technical security and risk. And he's currently on secondment to the UK National Cybercrime Programme to assist in the creation and launch of police-led cyber resilience centres, which I know a little bit about, and the development of the National Student Development Programme. Alan has enjoyed a technical security career spanning 25 years, initially working on the UK CNI for the MOD, MOJ and Security Service, with 15 years as an online investigator working with various agencies in profiling and managing online threats in the protection of high profile principals. So yeah, we know that there's a skill shortage in technology. It's not just cybersecurity, and this is the first episode in the series on technology jobs that we're doing here at Influential Visions. And, you know, it's really great that you guys have taken the time out to join us today. So Pratik, I know you've got some questions there, and you're dying to get stuck in. So please go for it.
Yeah. So thanks, Nat, for giving me this opportunity. And hello, gentlemen, Alan and David. It is nice to meet you as well. Yeah. So let me get started first with Alan. So my first question to you, Alan, is that what do you envisage as the emerging career opportunities within the cyber industry, like, say, within next 5 or 10 years?
I think there are a few things that are potentially going to be emerging. I mean, there's a lot of work being done right now on the likes of AI, blockchain, all those sort of emerging technologies. But I don't think that detracts from some of the career opportunities that have existed since I first started out. These career opportunities, though, evolve. I remember when I first started out my career, it was very much cybersecurity was in its infancy, and it's continually evolved, but the opportunity remains. So I think there's a wealth of opportunities for anyone who looks to get into cyber. And I don't think it's really about looking to see what's out in the next 5 or 10 years. It's more about what would you want to do within cyber as your career, and then make that fit into what the opportunities are. I mean, let's talk about AI could potentially do away with programming. We could reach a point where technology can actually code itself, but there's always going to be that requirement. When we got to the likes of year 2000, there was a lot of people who had developed a lot of skills over the previous 20 years in COBOL and Pascal. And all, that all came back into, absolute huge demand. And programming today, before we started this call, we're talking about the gaming industry. So everything evolves. And I think from my experience, the opportunities that I looked at when I first started out are still available today. They're just evolving. So it really depends on whether or not you want to look at, working in emerging technologies. You know, there are those who are very much focused on wanting to get involved in blockchain and what that could potentially mean to, the economy. and also, as I say, AI, and then we always talk about the Internet of Things. So it's there's always something new, but that doesn't detract from, you know, all of the kind of absolutely foundational careers that have been there since, you know, the dawn of technology, if you like.
Gosh. Yeah. I mean, yeah, I completely agree with what you just said. I mean, because I am at a very early stage of my career and I can completely relate to what you just said. And I personally, being a penetration tester, I see a lot of other domains such as threat intelligence, digital forensics, or network administration or network admin as a lot of opportunities here within India. I mean, you know, law enforcement is also something that people are going into as of now, especially if I talk about in India, like many of them do a cyber defense, which means they sort of protect the affected victims of sexual abuse or cyberbullying from getting, you know, committing any suicide kind of a thing. So, I mean, law enforcement also is a growing aspect when it comes to cyber field. But yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what you just said. And, you know, there are a wealth of opportunities going forward, especially when someone's starting in their career in cybersecurity. I mean, yeah.
I think just adding to that, as part of my current role, I'm interviewing a lot of students to join the National Cyber Resilience Center program, and to give students the opportunity while they're within further education to develop their skills. And we've partnered with about 45 universities throughout England and Wales. And I've met with and had the opportunity to speak to about maybe 300 students so far. And that's ongoing. And one of the questions that I always ask is that if I could potentially introduce them to an employer today, who would they like to be introduced to? And in the main, and I'm talking in the high 90%, the answer is government communications headquarters in the UK. So there's a real desire to go for the likes of government and security services. And I think it's potentially the perception of what that would be as a career opportunity. And maybe it's considered as a stepping stone into other things. And then when I ask them if I could introduce you to someone in private sector, it's always the big consulting or tech firms. And I think what slightly frustrates me, and hopefully that we're working to kind of correct this, is there's not a huge desire to work for SME tech firms. And I think as an opportunity for, if you're starting out your career, if you're working for a smaller business, you tend to be everybody's, you know, all hands to the pumps, and you get exposed to a far greater range of opportunity because you're a much smaller organization and everybody just has to kind of muck in. But it has been quite interesting in talking to those who are about to embark on their careers. What does your career look like for the next 5 or 10 years? And it very much is GCHQ and then into big consulting jobs. And it's whether or not that's right for the economy in the UK, and whether that's mirrored in other economies. And if not, how can we influence that?
Absolutely. I mean, can't agree more. So...
very interesting.
Yeah, very interesting as well.
So what about you, David? Do you want to give David the question again, Pratik?
Yeah. David, please let me know your thoughts on the same question. Absolutely.
I think there's actually kind of huge business opportunity. And, you know, cyber is... although fundamentally it's about, you know, being safe and availability and kind of protecting businesses, what I'm seeing a huge amount is that businesses are not able to do business unless they can evidence this in place. Number of kind of companies that I work for, their due diligence questionnaires are absolutely, you know, they're getting longer, 400 questions, huge amount of detail on cyber and data protection. And companies now, not only do they need to answer these questions, they're being asked to evidence it now as well. So it's almost like they're getting audited every time they take on a new customer. So when, as Alan was saying, an SME, the only way SMEs make kind of real money is dealing with bigger companies or government. And they have to demonstrate their abilities that they can deal with cyber, they can deal with data protection, they can deal with global issues. So actually, the opportunity now is actually cyber is a moneymaker. It facilitates deals, because without that, you won't get the big deals. You'd be lucky to get any. And sometimes I've seen that you're not even on the list to actually apply to be a supplier to some of these companies unless you can evidence that. So probably, I don't know, 5 years ago, roughly, what's that? 5 years ago, 2017, roughly 16. I never really saw small companies looking to do compliance projects, you know, ISO 27001, Cyber Essentials. Now it's gone crazy. I mean, the smallest company I've worked with, two-man company, they wanted ISO 27001. And I sort of said to them, are you sure you really want to do this? It's a lot of work. It's not that easy. And they said, we won't get the deals. And I've got to say, once they got ISO, they were closing roughly one. And these are serious companies and big government departments, probably one every 4 to 6 weeks because of cyber. Absolutely kind of incredible now. You know, cyber is a massive business enabler.
Of course, like I want to add to what you just said, because that was the time frame when GDPR also was coming into picture, and then, you know, I sort of got to know about GDPR once I was in the UK back in 2018, and that was, I believe, a game changer, you know, going forward in the coming years, because I've personally done my thesis on GDPR, and if if my research was correct, there was around £4 million fine if the companies don't follow the compliance or don't implement GDPR within a certain deadline. So that data protection played a huge role, or I would say, like, data protection became very important, you know, in those 2 or 3 years.
Absolutely. And what I sort of see is, and I run workshops for CISOs on data breach, not security incidents, data breach. And the overlap is enormous. I did some work for a government department a few years ago, and they had a couple of breaches, and they said, wow, your GDPR is really good. Well, actually, 20 plus years of dealing with breaches sort of helps, really. Because there's a huge overlap. And, you know, Pratik, as you were saying, you know, and I've read your thesis, the overlap now between cyber, data protection, privacy, data science, IT is huge. So what I normally find is the cyber guys know how the business runs, because they've had to understand every department, every system, find the vulnerabilities, what goes on. So the breadth of knowledge is just expanding. And obviously, the kind of complication is that you've got to be able to now talk to lawyers, data scientists, DPOs, CEOs, and get everyone to understand what the real risks are. You know, probably a few years ago, and maybe it is still partly true now, everyone loved a risk list. And as long as it was on the risk list, they didn't have to worry about it. Now those risks are pretty much real. So, you know, and this is just my interpretation, many of the standards that we have are in place because there was no legislation to enforce it. And as you say, with GDPR, there could potentially be high punishment. And I think there's a worse punishment than GDPR fines, and that is not getting any business. So, you know, that's the worst punishment. So effectively, all that is actually pushing cyber, data protection, data science, working with lawyers. It's just huge. I mean, I probably end up talking to lawyers 2 or 3 times a week. And it's really strange because, you know, probably 5, 6 years ago, very rarely would you talk to a lawyer, maybe in certain breach scenarios you would. But now it's everyday business.
Right.
It's just normal.
Right.
So in terms of jobs, Alan, where do you think this is sort of pushing us? Because, you know, it sounds like to me that cybersecurity is, people can get into cybersecurity, even if they're a lawyer, they can go into it and specialize in it. So do you think it's broadened the number of jobs, or is it, what's it sort of doing in that sort of context?
I think it's broadening the number of jobs, but I have an issue with the use of the word cyber in front of security. I think one of the challenges we face is the optics of wanting to, you know, pre-append a word in front of security. So it is just security, you know. Certainly within my career, a lot of the stuff that we were doing was actually physical security. And what I mean by that is that we would first compromise an organization before with it. And on occasion, we never used technology. So we were just trying to get an understanding of a risk position of a business. So to ensure that people who are coming into a career and are considering a career within technology, then I think it's important that we position what the opportunities are. And it does transcend legal, it does transcend physical and all elements of and business as well. Just very quickly touching on the program that we're involved on just now, I think one of the real values of that is providing policing the opportunity to run small businesses. So therefore, you have very senior police officers who are being exposed to what it's like to run a business and what some of the risks are. And just touching on something that David said there about, you know, which I absolutely agree with, that the technologists or cyber people have a really good understanding of the business. We then have to ask ourselves, does business have a really good understanding of the technology and the cyber? And I think the answer is no. And that's one of the big challenges. You know, I've worked with businesses of all sizes, and it's not related to vertical market. It's not related to turnover. And what is consistent is that the challenges and the risks that they face and their understanding of that, I think there's a lot of businesses operating at risk. Is that down to potentially a challenge in, you know, the number of people who are looking for cyber roles? I don't think so. I think there's a few things at play here. But in an answer to your question, I think that the industry is going to an absolute explosion of opportunity within the industry over the next few years. I think it's a fantastic industry to be in. But I think that what we have to do for those of us who are veterans in the industry is to make sure that those who come to us and say, I want to get into cyber, then just let them know. It transcends beyond that. There is huge opportunities. You don't have to be, you know, the world's best hacker or coder or networking person. You know, there's a wealth of skills that are required. And I think if we can kind of get that message out there, we'll start to help on the skill shortage.
Absolutely. I mean, I completely understand where David is coming from, because I keep seeing a lot of news and articles about there's a skill shortage of cybersecurity within the UK. And my doubt every time is that why is this skill gap not reducing? I mean, are people not interested or is it something else? But I think now I got my answer that it's about businesses and people willing to come forward and doing what they want to do. I mean, it's as simple as that.
There's maybe a disconnect between what is the opportunity. So what does the economy require? And what do people who want to get into the industry think the economy requires? I think that's where there's a potential disconnect. Because certainly there's a wealth of people who are going through further education and they're looking to come out the other side. But, you know, having the opportunity to speak to a lot of people, those studying to go into technology careers, I think what's clear is that they reach the end of further education and there's very much right now what? And I think there's also a concern that it evolves so quickly that what I'm studying in university may not translate to what the economy actually wants. And I think just in speaking to, you know, students generally, that they are very much focused on specific disciplines. I want to be a penetration tester. You know, I want to be involved in policy. I want to be involved in coding, etc. And the reason I was really keen to get involved in the project I'm on just now is because I started out that way. And then I realized that when opportunities present themselves, you know, just absolutely embrace them. You know, so for someone that started out as a technologist, how did I end up, you know, working on online protection for high profile individuals? That's not a career that my guidance counselor told me that was a thing at school. And it's that, you know, what do you want to do as an individual with your career? Where do you see that you can add value and you can really make your mark and professionally? And it's just, you know, pursue that.
Absolutely.
Very interesting.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I think it's making people more adaptable, isn't it? It's really just encouraging people to understand the fact that actually what they're learning right now may not be relevant. It may have some relevance, but it's not going to be totally relevant, is it? You know, so then it's sort of almost like, well, what do you enjoy doing on a daily basis, right? Like, because these things are really important. And then having a broad understanding of what actually goes into the mix within technology itself is such a great asset for people, right? So I'm really excited about the future. I think once we fix this communication problem and fix apathy as well, like apathy is the killer of jobs as far as I'm concerned. And in the next few years, you know, I agree with what you're saying about AI coming on board and everything else, guys, but like people still need to keep up, don't they, with actually what they have to do. Do you think that jobs are going to be easier for people, or do you think they're going to be harder? Do you think people are going to like work more or less in the next few years?
I think, you know, kind of building on kind of what Alan was saying, I think maybe even job is the wrong description, because that can evolve so rapidly. And, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, what you were doing 5-10 years ago, does that really exist in the same format? Probably not. So, you know, it's constant learning, constant adaptation to what's required. Although the principles may remain the same, which is really interesting, because quite often the underlying kind of thought patterns are there, but actually how you use them, how you adapt them to new environments and changing technology, it's still going to be there. But being classified as a job, which really means a job title, and that, you know, you stay in there for 500 years and that's it. It doesn't really exist in technology.
I think that would be a really good evolution. Let's dispense with the term job and the concept of job, and make it about what is my passion, what is my capability, and who can I bring, or what particular industry can I bring value to? And I think if you look upon it that way, you know, sometimes it does sadden me that when you speak to those who are coming into the industry, that they are so focused on, I want to be a penetration tester. And then when you start to challenge that, it's maybe potentially because there's financial forces that they believe that's the job to get into, because that's that pays all the money, or things along those lines. And it's trying to reset that and say, look, you want to get into something you feel passionate about, and you really want to, you know, you really want to be involved in for all the right reasons. And I'm sure, you know, remuneration is important in that. But I think you're right, even in the answer to your question, Nathan, it's very much about the evolution of the concept from job to I'm here, I've got 30 or 40 years to contribute to my professional life. And you know, how will that evolve?
And I think one of the things that I've kind of learned, having kind of been responsible for probably hundreds of people in various different roles, the one thing you really want from a good member of staff is adaptability. Somebody who can pick stuff up. And I noticed in certain areas where I've worked, you did have people that, yeah, they were good, but they really could only handle 1, 2, 3 different types of technology. And then you had the other extreme where you had, you know, staff who could handle, there was no limit how many numbers of technology they could really, really handle and manage. And it's not just about technology, it's about, you know, all the surrounding processes and understanding the business as well. And, you know, even in big companies, it sort of just tends to come down to, you know, maybe 5-10 people, if you're lucky, who really get it. And when you've got a problem, it's one of those guys you want to call, because they know how it all goes together. And I've been in companies few years, yeah, and I thought, you know what, I know what's going on. And then you discover a whole new world of stuff, and you realize the tip of the iceberg, that you actually don't know anything about this company. Yeah. And how it works and the technologies and who's involved. It's ginormous.
I completely understand what David just said, because even in penetration testing that I do every day in my there's one single thing that you have to do it, and it's boom, you know, it's all over the place. And that is the thing that people have to really focus. It's, as David said, it's just the tip of the iceberg. that people have to focus on, and rest is history, as they say. So yeah,
I think you're talking about getting into any sort of technology career, especially, you know, talking about the likes of penetration testing. If you're not taking time to study and better understand business and people, I think you're doing yourself a disservice, because a lot of the times when we're involved in security projects, it's actually, why did someone approach a process or a system in a certain way? And it's less about the technology, and it's more about, you know, what the processes or the policies within the organization. So you know, you're sitting, you're considering right now a career in technology. I would take some time out and you go and work for a small business, learn how business works, learn how people work and how to, you know, why people do certain things. And the whole social engineering element, I think, is incredibly important if you're specifically looking to get into a career in security.
Yes. So social engineering is something very, very crucial, be it any domain within cyber. Social engineering is extremely crucial. I think first step.
Sorry to interrupt. Can you explain in this context what that actually means? Because I don't know what you mean. And I've studied cyber, like, not in a great detail, but I've studied cyber for 5 years, and I don't know what you mean by social engineering in this context. I think maybe that's a dumb question.
No, not at all. I think the history of technology has some very key people. And anyone that's looking in to get into industry, I always refer them to the likes of Kevin Mitnick, who is now, you know, a very prominent speaker within the industry, Kevin Poulsen, and there was a wealth of people, and their skills back in the time when they were active within, you know, cybersecurity, and what they were really doing was testing the extents of the technology. So that's when the word hacker was more a badge of honor. And what you were actually doing was testing and trying to get technology to do things it wasn't designed to do. And I think it saddens me slightly that we've moved away from that. But back then, a lot of some of the greatest system compromises where the technology was really tested didn't actually involve technology. What it did was, is if you look at some of the work that was done on some of the big telcos where people were making free phone calls, or were managing to do things with a telecoms network in the very early stages of that particular technology, all they were doing was identifying who had the authorization to make changes, phoning them up, and then convincing them to make the changes for them. And you know that anytime you talk to anyone who works within security, they'll always have a story about the number of times that whilst they've been, you know, legitimately testing a company's security, they phoned someone up and had them change their password, or provide them with a password, etc. And that goes back, you know, 30, 40 years, that particular approach. So is it possible to compromise systems and gain access to an organization's secret sauce that's stored on a technical platform without accessing technology? Yes. More often than not, what you have to do is understand how the business works, how the who is an authority, who has access to what you need access to, and then phone them up and ask them. And that's very much the social engineering element. So just very quickly, by way of an example, I was asked to test a large manufacturing organization. And they all wore blue coats. They had these blue uniforms. It's like a tunic that they wore over their shirt and tie. And they all had lanyards. And I just ordered one off Amazon. I think it was like £6. It came in the mail. I put it on. I tucked my lanyard into the blue coat, as they all did, because the weight of it was annoying. And I explored all of the sensitive areas of that factory. I mean, there was no real technology there. People are incredibly polite. They'll hold the door open for you, even when they're told not to. And as long as you look like you should be somewhere, then they won't challenge you. And that is all the time that I speak to students and I ask them about their aspirations to get into security. It's not something that people regularly want to be involved in. There's nobody that has come to me and said, I want to test the physical security and the processes of an organization by, you know, using such techniques. But if you look at some of the really the really huge intrusions that we've suffered over the last 20 years, many of them actually involve quite an important piece of social engineering. So where someone has used techniques, etc., to gain so far, and then at that point they then use technology, and both come hand in hand. So I think from a social engineering perspective, I think we need to find a cuddlier term rather than social engineering. It's you know, it sounds a little bit foreboding, but that aside, it's you to be a good penetration tester or red team, I think you have to have skills in both of those particular disciplines.
Absolutely. And there's a book came out in 1988, The Cuckoo's Egg by Clifford Stoll. And I gave that to my son a few years ago, yeah, and he kind of read it. And he goes, but this is still happening. And that was effectively how a group social engineered most of the US military, got access to loads of systems, and they levered off using universities as a leverage point in kind of summary. Same thing still happening. And I suppose the one thing I suppose we've got to ask ourselves is, where did computers originate from and what was their purpose? Yeah. Their purpose was hacking. We just use them for other stuff now.
Yeah.
And just adding to that,
Second World War.
Look, he's grinning. Pratik's grinning. You mentioned the word hacking and he starts smiling.
Just touching on something that David mentioned there, I genuinely could take an assessment report I wrote in the 90s and update the organisational name and submit it today. And what was found back then, the technology has evolved, but the actual nature of the vulnerabilities are pretty consistent. And as David says, it's because it always comes back down to people. People are designing the systems, etc. You know, and a lot of the times it's less about the technology and more about the people. Web assessment that we're involved in recently, when you actually, you had to pay online for information. And then when you went to pay online, it popped up a box and asked you what type of payment you would like to use. And the only option was credit card. So as a social engineer, I'm looking at a website and say, why would you ask me how I should pay for this service if there is only one payment method? And then so in the background, you can intercept that and replace it. And I've replaced it with purchase order. And there was a hidden screen popped up that someone had been developing. And you could put a purchase order number in, and then it gave you all the service for free. And so that's somebody's mindset had developed that, etc. And that vulnerability I seen back in the 90s, and then recently on an assessment project we were involved in, very similar approach. So it's, you know, the people element's very important, and that's, we drop the cyber term.
And I think that highlights the point that technology fundamentally is unregulated. You know, and GDPR was potentially one of the first big ones. You know, when you see regulation in every industry, from food, airplanes, cars, safety became a priority. And I think the one thing we know, there is no real safety in IT because there's not enough regulation. And then the argument is, if you regulate, it will stifle innovation. Or you look at aircraft, you look at cars, it's got bigger, faster and safer. And food, we can all go out to a restaurant and we know we're not going to hopefully kind of die from eating the food. Flying a plane, same thing. And IT, it's not quite there yet. And what I see is that people put stuff together brilliantly, but we know we can do crazy stuff with IT now. They don't really think safety, compliance first, or security. It's let's do the whiz bang stuff, yeah, and worry about the other stuff as a retrofit. And that's the problem. Security, compliance shouldn't be retrofitted. It's way too hard.
If you hold a position on a board, then one of the first topics that are covered at a board meeting is health and safety. So more often than not, boards always touch on health and safety. And I think the second thing should be IT risk and risk to the business from the use of technology. I think if we can get that mindset at board level, and then it'll trickle down. And it goes back to what we're saying earlier, that the technologists absolutely understand the business. They have to make sure that the technology is fit for purpose, but the business potentially doesn't understand the technology. And you can be involved in some very interesting meetings where you have technologists who are speaking all about the technology, and they're going into, you know, great detail. And then you have the business principals who are party to that conversation saying, I don't understand what you mean. Is this bad? Why is it bad? How much is it going to cost to fix? Can I fix it using money? And it's trying to find that kind of common ground, that translation piece. And I think that can kind of go a long way. So there's definitely huge opportunities for anyone wanting to get into, you know, technology. But I think if it were I and I was going to start my career again, I would want to get involved in business early on and really understand business, etc., so that I wasn't completely focused on the technology and being technology led. I think you need to understand both worlds, or a number of different worlds.
Right. So what about you, David? What sorry to interrupt. What about you, David? What advice would you give your younger self if you were where Pratik is, or actually pre-Pratik? So before Pratik started, if you could speak to him or your younger self, what would you say about your career and what you should do to get into cyber? If you decided that was a security, not cyber, we'll call it security, yeah? Would you start doing external security? What would you do?
I think, as Alan said, it's kind of interesting because I've done a kind of reasonable amount on physical and kind of personnel kind of security as well. And when you deep dive on it, the principles are the same, or they should be the same. You know, say for example, you're looking after a building, you would have an outer ring, inner ring, all that kind of stuff to see, you know, what's going on. And you effectively are doing the same in the electronic world, although you may not realize that's what you're doing. So the principles are the same. And I think maybe it's getting as much experience, and I'm probably echoing Alan here, yeah, it's getting as much experience in as many different areas as possible. You know, I think one of the areas, you know, that probably took me a long time kind of mentally to kind of adjust to, yeah, I really hated policy, process and governance. I kind of thought, and I'm sure most people do, that you kind of don't see the initial value of it. Now I've gone around totally 180 degrees. You know, I used to do this talk that, you know, a policy won't protect you from hackers. No, it doesn't protect you from hackers. But what it does do, it gets everyone aligned in the company, and everyone is agreed that this is how you work. And going back to Alan's analogy, it's really the health and safety. You know, when you're in a factory, you don't carry sharp knives and walk on an oil floor. Same thing in the IT world. You know, you have to have those policies and the understanding and the reasons why they're there, because that's the thing that will help at the end of the day. And kind of managing risk. I think that the trouble is there's really two types of risk. Health and safety risk is you're going to get fined if someone gets hurt, full stop. There will be big trouble. IT risk, yeah, we you know, if you ask us, four of us, about risk to one thing, we'll come up with 14 different variants of risk. It's like seatbelts. You know, I don't know about you guys, you can remember when seatbelts were first engaged, but you know what? I hate wearing seatbelts. I still hate wearing seatbelts, but I wear them because there's two risks. One, I'm going to crash, have an accident. Two, I'm going to get stopped by the police. And it has worked. That risk assessment that we do when we get in a car has been taken away from us. You wear a seatbelt. It's mandatory. And I think maybe that's where some things need to go, that, you know, certain things need to be mandatory in a system rather than let's risk assess it and then decide whether it's cost benefit analysis. It doesn't work because I have to say, unless it was law, I probably wouldn't wear a seatbelt. Now it's law, I wore a seatbelt for obviously years. And I think that helps, having regulation in line with what's required. I mean, for example, if you look at the stats that have come out, I think of every single security kind of report for the last sort of 15 years, the two big things are people, yeah, and effectively faulty passwords, however you want to describe that. So if we made it legislation, we get rid of people and we put in multi-factor, we'd have a perfect scenario. Obviously, that's totally realistic, but we could mandate, and it is coming. You can't get cyber essentials easily now. You know, thankfully, they've really upped the game now. If you have multi-factor, you must use it. And I think those are going to make huge differences.
So what about when you're going to start out? Would you advise any particular study, area of study, any specific short course to start with?
I think it's one of those things where you've got to learn as much as possible, be interested in everything. You know, whatever I say now, yeah, probably in 3 weeks' time, that may not be the case. You've got to see what's happening, where there's failure, where there's opportunity. As quoting Alan again, there is tons of it around, and it's focus on those areas. And I think kind of developing your skills as a fast learner. I remember kind of talking once to a lawyer on a train, and he was going all the stuff he has to read, and I'm going, I probably read five times as many books as he does, and I have to understand them in 3 weeks' time so I can get stuff done. You know, you have to absorb huge amounts of information, and getting good at that, I think, is key. Read everything. Some of it isn't right. Some of it would be absolute rubbish. But after a while, you get, you know what, this doesn't work. Interesting kind of concept. And it's just constantly learning and evaluation.
I think there's two reasons why that's incredibly important. The first is that can you truly understand the particular discipline or area of expertise that you want to go into if you don't understand the foundations of everything else? So the number of times that I've, you know, been in discussion with very accomplished and very skilled testers, but then you start to look at their foundational knowledge on wider networking, wide area networks, etc., and there's maybe significant gaps there. And the risk is that they could potentially, you know, miss a vulnerability because they didn't quite understand how the technology kind of hangs together. But also in early career, I would just echo what David said there, and that is really, you know, try everything. So get involved in as much of the technology as you can, because it offers you a significant foundation for whatever you decide to do. And then in trying everything, you can get to that point where you say, I found my space, I found what I really enjoy, and I'm going to absolutely focus on that. I think coming to technology to say, I want to be a pen tester because, you know, it pays the big bucks, and I know a lot of people that have done it and they say it's a really rewarding career, is potentially not the way to do it. It's maybe not right for everyone. It's about, you know, it's developing, moving away from jobs, developing careers, and seeing what can I do to better myself and develop my skills that people will find value in, and therefore I will continually be gainfully employed.
Super, super. Well, I think that's a great place to end on. Do you agree, guys? Or is there anything else, any more words of wisdom you'd like to give to people?
The only thing I would add is that any opportunity that presents itself, I would absolutely embrace it, because if you don't, you will know the outcome. If you do, the outcome could potentially be the greatest opportunity you've ever faced. And certainly that's how my career has evolved in the rather bizarre way that it has, but it's worked out for me. So that's the best advice I can give.
I'd echo Alan. I'd say every single kind of permanent role I've had, the role didn't really exist before I was in it. I had to make it, and there was no template to follow.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections. And don't forget to drop us a review wherever you listen. Thanks.